Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome to the first show of the new season. I'm so excited to be here. On each podcast, I interview an extraordinary person on how they've navigated their way through life to come to a place that where they find happiness and fulfillment. This often involves a ton of missteps, course corrections, divots, possible derangement, but ends up in a really great place. And today, my guest is someone who was at one time addicted to alcohol, pot, cigarettes. She was bulimic. She was depressed. And sitting here in front of me, I have someone who, after all of those challenges, is smiling in the most peaceful, beatific way. She invented her own recovery, and that recovery is the foundation of an extraordinary business that is going to grow and that you are going to hear so much about. But you're going to have heard about it first, perhaps here on Speaking Broadly. My guest today is Holly Whitaker, and her unbelievable company is called Hip Sobriety. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me and all those kind words.
Oh, there's more kind words to come.
I think it's so funny because it's my business now talking about my recovery, and I'll go and I'll tell somebody about my story, and then they're like, wow, thanks for sharing that. And I was like, yeah, on to the next, because it's just, I don't take a moment to really absorb that and how that might come across to somebody else for the first time. To me, it's not extraordinary anymore. It's just so typical to talk about. And so it was really lovely to kind of hear you say it the way you just said it. So
I think that your sense of appreciation is part of why you are in the place you are today, because you have appreciation not only for the journey that you've had, but the struggle that everybody goes through as they're facing the challenges inherent in recovery and addiction. So yeah. I want to go back to that place that actually feels to you quite long ago, mm-hmm. and is, because we're talking about 2012.
Yeah.
But sometimes mental time and actual time attenuate and feel quite different. And I think 2012 now for you feels like, wow, was that me? Because mm-hmm. it's so different. But can you take your mind back and describe to us, like, in 2012, which you call like the peak of your addictions, what was that like? What were you dealing with on a daily basis?
I think it's really important to state that I don't remember most of 2011. I was so dissociated from, I was just going through the motions. In 2012, kind of the first part of it, I feel the same. And so describing it, I can't remember I don't know how I made it through, and I don't know what my daily life was like, but I was, I'd had an eating disorder.
Can we just pause it?
Sure.
You don't remember, and you don't have those ideas. Is that because of the blur of alcohol and addiction, or is it because really, like, you just, you don't remember?
If I can be graphic for just a second, when you are binging and purging, when the only way I can describe this is I would have an episode where I was, it's not just being drunk and being high and being disassociated. There's also like the disassociation that you make when you can't live with yourself, and you just have, like, when you're doing things just to make it by, but you're also not reconciling that you're doing those things, and you can't reconcile that. Like you're off doing this one thing and your soul is like tucked away somewhere inside you and you're just not connected. And so when I would do, like, I would go and I would get a grocery bag full of food and then I would eat it as quickly as possible. And then I would throw it up. And then I would clean up the scene, and I just would, like, while I was doing the whole thing, I would, like, close my eyes, and I wouldn't look at the scene until it was clean. And because it was just, like, it was so painful, I couldn't be there. And so I think 2010 was, like, the start of this this like downward spiral. I got like, it's just, it was the start of it, like that it started to pile up. And then 2011 was being so drenched in it. And then 2012 was like hitting the bottom of it. And then it was also the rise from it. And so I don't remember the year 2011 the way that most people might remember the year, like, or remember a year. It just, or the way that I remember 2018 or 2017. I just don't remember that I wasn't here, if that makes any sense.
And so at what point did you open your eyes, right? You said you hit a rock bottom. Does that like connect to a moment in your mind, or is it a series of events in which you said, okay, I'm done now, or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was just these things like that were piling up that I couldn't really look away from, and it was getting harder to keep it all together, and I was really sick. I mean, I was 33, and my body was physically very ill, and I was not sleeping. I was working. I had multiple addictions. I mean, it was just like, it was not going well. But, you know, I think there were moments of like having this recognition that like I was coming to the end of something that I'd been trying to keep up. I had run out of duct tape. I wasn't able to keep it a secret. I just wasn't able to keep it together anymore. And I think probably like there were a couple things, and the things I remember were a trip to Mexico where I was with one of my good friends and it was his 40th birthday. And I just remember him talking about his friend that wasn't there because his friend had stopped drinking. And I had this like it was just like a collision of a moment of being like, this might be my last trip to Mexico, and like drinking in a pool, you know. And I think
and why would it be your last trip?
Because I just saw myself in his friend's story, and I was like, this is why it's so important. I think the way that we approach, like the way that my company approaches addiction at this point, and the way we talk about it, to me, it was just the end of the, like, that was it. My life was over. I would never get to do these things again. I would be this guy that was sitting back in the Midwest somewhere, not able to join the party because he couldn't help himself and he was around alcohol. And he just had to sit out the rest of it. Because this is what I prioritized and valued. And so I had that moment. And then I had a moment when I was in Costa Rica not long after that with a friend. And I was just like, I mean, I was doing things that were shocking myself. When I would get drunk, I would just do things that totally shocked myself, that it was something that was so painful. And I couldn't believe I would, you know, like I would drink in the morning, and like things like this just started to get really, started to get really slippery and blurry. And like, I was in Costa Rica with one of my girlfriends, and I just was jokingly but seriously said, if I don't stop drinking when I get back, or if I don't change my relationship, like I'm gonna need an intervention. And she laughed it off, and I was like, but this is a very, like, I mean, she just, but you know, like we all
she didn't
kind
know what
of,
to do.
But she also, and I just don't even, but I'm like, I also ran in a circle of people that like I drank the same as, you know. And so it was also just like real, like I hit a lot of my more shocking behaviors, but my drinking was on par with my friends and my group of friends. And I think this is like another big piece of this, which is that it, like, dysfunctional drinking, like it's so normalized, and we kind of also like find people that drink like us that we can just so easily say, well, I'm not as bad as them, or they're doing it too. And so like this person, like that I said this to, like, you know, like didn't have that much healthy of a relationship outwardly appearing than I did. And So anyways, there was that. And then I think like it was just like the skid to a halt. Like in September 2012, I was working on a really, really big project at work, and I've been working every single weekend. And I think I just like, I was on my way to a friend's house on Sunday night that I was doing, that my product partner, and I was just so, I just, like I couldn't do it anymore. And I had been like previously in a romantic relationship with the head of our company, and I, on the way to do this like weekend, like this, like the same thing every weekend, like working every weekend for as long as I could remember at that point, I like basically called the CEO of the company and then called my boss and just was like, you know, like quit my job, kind of like
on the road. That's
like, it was just like, it was just the pressure of it was building, and I just was so desperate, and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't figure out what was bleeding. And And I talked, and I didn't quit my job. They both gave me a week off, and they were like, you know, this is, you probably just need some time. But it was just like pieces of this. Like, this is like what was happening. And it just felt like at any moment, it is just going to implode. And so my ultimate bottom was I just, I would go on benders. I would like start on a Thursday or a Friday. I would work through the weekend. I would drink. I would balance that drinking out with smoking pot and with caffeine and with binging and purging. And I just like, and it would sometimes carry through to the next week. And I woke up on a Tuesday morning and I think probably September or October of 2012. It was October, early October 2012. And I like, it was just like, I would outwardly appearing. I was a director at a company. I had a great career. I seemed together. And I woke up in my apartment and I didn't have sheets on my bed. And my apartment was full of trash because it had been 4 days of like just working, eating, purging, drinking, like smoking. My nightstand was like literally an ashtray. I had just gone outside the ashtray and I was just there was like joints and cigarettes and ashes, just like my whole, like the whole top of it was covered. There were bags of takeout food and trash, like just littered across the apartment. There was there was beer like spilled and stuck to the floor. I woke up in my bed. It had no sheets. And it had like a duvet, or not a duvet, it had a like a whatever, goose down comforter. And my TV was still on. My laptop was still on. And I had like a pint of Jameson in my hand and there was still some in it. And I had a meeting to lead. And it was a work day morning. And I was probably still drunk and I was like hungover. And I it's as like cliche as it gets, but I just like screamed. I fell on the floor. I screamed, I cried, and I asked for help. I mean, I just screamed like, I can't do this. I cannot do this. And I think, I just broke and like screamed like for God to help me. And I didn't believe in God. And just like, you know, like drooled. It was just like the ugly cry of like this in the middle of like my squalor. And like I picked myself up and I cleaned my, you know, and then I got ready and I went to work. And so, yeah, it was just, and that was like this, you know, I mean, it was just this moment. It's like, it was.
So if that was, the bottom.
Yeah.
That seems like a rough place to land. But then something within you, one of the things that's so interesting is all this time that you were, drinking and smoking, you were also working really hard. And so these two things coexisted within you, right? The denial and the success, which I think is so interesting because at some point, mm-hmm. 2012 October, you chose to take the part of you that knew how to succeed,
mm-hmm.
and you focused on that part, right?
Because project managed it, you know,
right? You kind of exactly, and not everybody has that duality. You know that they really are killing it. A lot mm-hmm. of people who face these challenges, the challenges swamp them in every way,
mm-hmm.
but. How did you, in fact, project manage your way out of that low?
Yeah. I think it was, there's just this piece of that I think is really important in everyone's journey, which is just that moment was a moment of surrender. I had been trying to keep it all together for so long, and I was not going to relinquish. I was not going to go to rehab. I was not going to, you know, it wasn't like this was that moment on the floor was when I was like, maybe something's wrong. I knew something was wrong. I just was refusing to do something about it. And that was like, it was surrender. That's what surrender is. Surrender is saying I can't do it and I need help, even if it's to nobody. You know, and when I said that, whatever it was, the intention within me, the energy within me, the call, like the answer to the call that I was making to the universe, to God, to whatever, it just was answered. And it was answered really quickly. And these events like very quickly unfolded after this. Like it's just so random, but I like went to go get my Starbucks and my Starbucks sandwich and my coffee and to come back and like get myself together to go to work at, right after that like whole scene. And then when I walked into my building, like still like, you know, alcohol, when you're hungover and you've been hungover for like a couple years, you just have like this slowness and this fogginess in your brain, and things sometimes seem really distorted. And I walked into the lobby of my building that morning, and there was this guy from that I'd worked with that I didn't work with anymore standing in the lobby of my building with my building manager. And I was like, what are you doing here? And like literally not even a half hour after that whole scene. And like, he's like, I'm moving into this building. And it was like, you know, 9 a.m. or 8:30 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. And I was just, and then he and I took a walk. And it's not to go deep into that story because it's a really long story, but the whole point of it is that he, that conversation I had with him led to a conversation I had with a friend a couple nights later whose kids I was babysitting for. The guy was a doctor. I worked with him. And that conversation I had with that guy that morning led to this conversation with that doctor, who then brought up the possibility of borderline personality disorder. And then hearing the words borderline personality disorder, like the second I heard them, I was like, I feel like that's what I have, even though I had no idea what it was. And then when that night when, you know, this man whose kids I was babysitting for went to dinner with his wife, I looked up borderline personality disorder and I had like the markers of it, like 8 out of 9. And I was never diagnosed with it. But like this is kind of how addiction goes. It just mimics a lot of personality disorders and it's really hard to pull it apart. But that when I researched borderline personality disorder, it was like, oh, I potentially have, you know, a severe mental illness. And that was relieving. That was like, to me, that was more palatable than alcoholism. And I could work with a mental, like I could work with a mental illness. I couldn't work with alcoholism. To me, alcoholism, because of all the ideas we have about willpower, and this like relapsing person that just spends their life trying not to drink and that eventually dies from it 20 years later. And we know this story, right? Like, but it's just, you don't like, to me, I was like, I can handle the mental illness. I cannot handle the alcoholism. But reading about borderline personality disorder opened up this potential, like it basically said, don't drink. If you want to get this under control, do not drink. And that was, so I bought 2 books that night, and one of them was Stop Walking on Eggshells or something, some borderline personality disorder book. And the other was The Easy Way to Control Alcohol by Alan Carr. So that's a very long way of saying my introduction into like project managing my addiction and kind of doing it on my own started with reading a book that changed my subconscious beliefs around alcohol. And the story's like really fast, but like I read that book, and then within a couple of weeks, I decided it wasn't even that I couldn't drink anymore. It was that I no longer wanted to drink. It changed my entire appreciation of and understanding of what alcohol is. And it made me absolutely never want to drink again. So that's part of it, but not all of it.
I'm fascinated by that pivot because I think that so many people struggle at exactly that point, right? Like,
yeah, forever, for long periods of time.
And
yeah,
talking about what AA talks about, which is you're an addict forever. Mm-hmm. And I think you were relieved of that narrative that you are not an addict forever.
Yeah.
And you've founded a company on this notion, yeah, of self-recovery, well, accessibility, social proof, not anonymity.
Yeah.
All of which are really, really important. But I think that they start with this notion that, you know, you're not an addict forever.
Yeah, and we don't even use the word addict. I mean, like, people don't even, like, this is, like, one of these things. Like, there is, but, like, people call themselves addicts, but, like, we don't label, we are really encouraging for people to figure out whatever labels work for them. I think, like, it is, like, one of the things, yeah, like, yes, absolutely. Like, I was fortunate enough to have this, like, before I went down the road of claiming this identity as an alcoholic, I was introduced to a concept that said, maybe there's something wrong with you. Maybe there's something wrong with what we've been conditioned to do. Maybe there's something wrong with some other stuff. And to me, one of the arguments was like...
I mean, this gets to the root of like, what are the root causes of people who drink too much? Or
yeah.
And yeah, I'm curious about that.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about that?
Sure.
Or like, okay. Well, I think this is like kind of the crux of it, right? It's that I think, you know, AA was founded in the 1930s, and it's something we have people that use our program also use AA. And I think like it's really important to kind of set this out before I start talking about this, that any way that anybody finds relief is great. Like everything, we need to be more supportive. You know, people that are taking cancer drugs and arguing with other people that are, you know, using CBD oil about who is doing it the right way. It's not a threat to have different cancer treatments. And for whatever reason, when we start talking about addiction, we like it becomes a threat. Like a different way is a threat to an existing way. And
to be fair, I'm not sure I agree with you with the cancer.
Oh, well, no, actually, that is a pretty poor, like that, no, I think it's to the degree, though, yes, I think you're actually right. That's a pretty bad generalization. But I think coming back to it, yeah. it is just there, you will find that there is a lot of, you know, this is the one right way. And that's changed a bit. It's changed a lot. There's been a lot of different, like, modalities that have emerged in the last, you know, 10, 20 years, women for sobriety, there's rational recovery, there's integral recovery, there's like, you know, I could go on and list all these different ways, refuge recovery. But there still is this, there is still, because AA is, you know, it was developed in the 30s when there was really no known treatment. It was what really like drove the understanding of the word sobriety, alcoholism. It really is, and it established itself as the one way. Nobody was treating in any sort of meaningful way addiction, and AA came on the scene in the 30s. It's created, and it, you know, in a very short period of time, relatively speaking, it becomes ubiquitous. It's where medical professionals, you know, refer people to. It kind of takes it and runs with, like, this idea of being, like, the way that people recover from addiction. And because of that, and because it's also not changed, it's remained, like, intact since its, like, inception. The big book hasn't changed. It's been expanded upon. The 12 steps haven't changed. Like... And it's also decentralized, meaning it's like not governed by a central body. Each individual meeting or like a chapter, you know, or meeting group will, you know, set the terms. But the point is that it has like gained this traction, and it's how we think about addiction, right? Like even if, you know, even it might like people that I, when I was recovering, people that had never struggled with addiction themselves and didn't even know anybody that had struggled with addiction were just assumed that I should be doing AA and working a 12-step program. And there is this idea like this is the one way and this is how it works. And if you don't do this program, you're in denial of your addiction, or you're not really like, you know, like the first step is, you know, like, it, you know, basically admitting that you can't, you know, admitting that you're an alcoholic, right? And so there is like this society, like that society believes, like, and we've all kind of bought into this. And this is like very specific with alcohol, right? Because you're supposed to consume alcohol. It's a rite of passage, especially in America. It is something that we are like expected to do. It's a weird thing. If you don't drink, it's like the one drug that you have to explain why you don't use it. And so we're supposed to use it. We're also supposed to like use it responsibly and not go off the deep end with it and like have a successful relationship with it. And we don't really go into it with like an idea of like informed consent of like, you know, what it does to you, or like the same way you might if you were to take a prescription. And so we have this like this binary with it. Like there's normal drinkers and then there's alcoholics. And alcoholics, there's nothing wrong with the alcohol. There's something wrong with the person. And we don't really say that about cigarettes. We don't say that about cocaine. Like, we don't say that about heroin. Well, we really do specifically say this about alcohol. And so it drives this like binary of there's something wrong with the individual. And this is what, like, because AA has been so prolific and because it's, I mean, and it, like, again, coming back to this, it's helped many, many people. It's also not helped many people. But, like, it has like kind of been the way. And because of that, and because of the assertions that it makes, we have an allergy to the substance. We are not normal. We are alcoholics. It like takes the blame and it like places it on the individual and it's like something's wrong with you. And so because of that, we just focus on the individual and we try and pull it apart. And we're like, well, why would they be that way? Why would they not be able to ingest ethanol? And, you know, and so we just like try and focus on that. And then it takes this idea, it takes the whole picture. It like basically it silos off that these people that struggle with this live in a society and in within a culture and with and that they are responding to those things and working within those things and that they and that so when you know you like coming back to what you said is like what is the like you know what causes addiction and when I when we try and pull it apart the way we explain it in our program we use something that's called the psychobiosocial model, which just means psychology, biology, sociology, and there's also like psychobiosocial spiritual model, like there's but the idea is that it's the biology, it's the psychology, it's the sociology, it's like it's not just one thing. And so when you're looking at an individual, I mean all people reach outside of themselves, all people have addictions to some degree. We all use something outside of ourselves, some externality in order to manage ourselves and manage our energy and make it through this life. And some of those things are very healthy things. And like the old definitions of addiction were positive and negative. People could have addictions to the church. They could have addictions to like service. And so like I could currently like be said as like having an addiction to helping people recover from addiction. And so like my life is given to it, right? And that would be like in the old definition of addiction, I would fall into that, but it would be a healthy thing because it's contributing to society. But everybody to some degree uses something to manage themselves, and they do this like what they, you know, they like they reach outside of themselves for like so many reasons. And so we try and like boil it down, and there's no alcoholic gene, like specifically talking about alcohol. There's just like there's a human that grew up in a culture with like some sort of genetic predisposition. If we're talking about alcohol specifically, you know, like there is like there's no alcoholic gene, but there is like, you know, like genetically are you programmed to respond to alcohol in a way that you have a low tolerance or a high tolerance? Are you a resilient person, or does it take you time to like get up off your feet after you've been knocked down? And then you go into like what were the cultural beliefs that you were raised in? What did your parents model to you? What was your peer group like? Did you grow up with access to systems, or were you disenfranchised? Did you learn coping mechanisms? There's all of these things that develop in like in each of us individually and separately, and how we develop determines whether or not, and to the extent which we'll need to use things outside of ourselves to manage ourselves. And we'll try different things. And some of us, I mean, I've been gambling. I haven't become addicted to gambling, nor do I think would I ever. And, you know, but like some
people. Did
that
make you nervous at all?
No, I just never, yeah. It's boring. Like, it's just not, like, it's just never been, you know, it just was not. Like, and this is why there's a unique fit for a lot of us. We'll go out and we'll find like, like that hits, like that's something that like that does it for me. And so for me, it was, you know, like the unique fit was alcohol. And the thing is with a chemical, if it's alcohol, if it's, you know, like an illicit drug, if it's a chemical, like even coffee, but like, let's just say alcohol, if it's alcohol, and you use that and you find, oh, this does the trick. This either like allows me to socialize more freely, or this like allows me to not be so anxious, or maybe this just like allows me to make dinner when I get home from work, or it allows me to like, you know, whatever it does, it soothes this thing that feels off. What happens is if we start using it over time, it just exacerbates all those other things. So again, like coming on to like the drivers that make us reach outside of ourselves, like for instance, if like depression is one of those things, it's going to exacerbate depression. And then what do? We reach outside and back for it. And so the drivers of it are as much the society we live in, as much as like the individual ways we were raised, the way our biology is, how much meaning we have. And, you know, like it's just, I mean, it could go on and on, but it's as much as makes us human.
That's a lot of options that you've laid out there. Thank you for that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, believe it or not, we're going to get to the hedonistic side, because one of the fascinating things I think about Holly's approach is if you decide that alcohol isn't something that you want as part of your life. It's not like you're signing off of a great life. That fear that Holly had way back when in Mexico, that she'd be that miserable guy in the Midwest, you know, with nothing to do, and the fear of being drawn into an unfortunate incident, that doesn't have to be you. And one of the reasons that I dwell on that here on Speaking Broadly is that in the food industry, we have a really, really difficult time with alcohol. The servers are and back of the house are around alcohol all the time. And it feels like, you know, what would life be like if we didn't, if we weren't drinking? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in some ways, this conversation with Holly seems outside of this world of food and hospitality, and it's other, but it's actually critical and crucial, and to understand how you can live positively, happily, and without that feeling of either deprivation or judgment is important. And that's what we're going to delve into after the break. So be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Speaking Broadly, the first episode of the season, and I am very happy in what is called Dry January to have Holly Whitaker here with me in the studio. I had never heard of Dry January. Is that something that's been around for a long time?
No. I mean, I think it started, you know, there was like something, there's something called Hello Sunday Morning. And Hello Sunday Morning is a group of people in New Zealand that just go on 3 month alcohol freeze. And they call it like, I'm doing a Hello Sunday Morning. And it's just meant to explore life. And the founder of it drinks. They're not about like not drinking. They're about mindful drinking. And I think that then after that happened, I want to say it then moved to the UK. The UK has had a jump, like, because of the higher, they have higher levels of addiction and more people drink in the UK. It's just like, it's worse than it is here. And I think it started in the UK because they were just trying to have awareness around alcohol. And then it's come to the United States in the last couple of years. But maybe 4 years ago, no, like when I was researching it, no one was doing it in the United States. And it was something that I wanted to try and do, and like a movement I wanted to try and lead that I quickly abandoned. But
why is that? Well, I guess it existed. That's one reason to abandon it. But
no, I mean, I think like, no, I wanted to like get a bunch of my friends that were like sobriety people, like to like kind of promote it together and put a course together. But I think it was just, I don't know, probably other priorities. And also I think it's like, I think that Dry January, it's this interesting thing. It is, you know, sometimes Dry January is just about waiting for like February 1st and it's, you know.
Right. That's not really solving a problem. It's right. It's a nice little challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I have mixed feelings about it. But it's not something I promote, you know.
I was asking you because I figured you would have mixed feelings about it because it's setting a timer.
Yeah.
On something that actually should be a lifestyle, not a timer.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I had sober. I mean, I think anything that we do, like, here's the thing. We can talk about, like, if we are deciding to take a break from sugar, we can walk up to people and say, hey, I'm going to not eat sugar. And, like, nobody's going to freak out. But if we say, like, yeah, I think I'm, like, or I could say, I think I have a problem with, like, you know, gluten, or I think I have a problem. Like, we can talk about a number of things that we think we have a weird relationship with, coffee or sugar or the internet. And we can talk about it, and it's not like this weird thing. But if we say, like, I feel like I have a problem with alcohol, people get really nervous about that. Like, it's like immediately associated with, oh, do you think you're an alcoholic? And so it's something that we don't really know how to talk about. We really don't know how to talk about, like, just navigating our relationship with it and having mindfulness around it, right? And conscientiously, like looking at it. And so I think this opens up that dialogue for being able to, like, talk in, you know, amongst friends about how alcohol shows up in our life, and instead of it being this secret thing that we kind of do and figure out on the internet late at night, you know?
So let's talk about the ways in which you embrace this notion of hedonist and not prohibitionist. One of the things you love to do is travel. I mean, you love Italy almost more than anyone I've ever met.
I said it like 10 times. Yeah.
I think
yes.
And Italy for you for a long time was identified with amazing food and amazing wine. How did your relationship with travel change, and how did you keep it joyful?
I've never had alcohol in Italy, actually.
You've never had alcohol?
No. I grew up, like, I've been obsessed with Italy since, like, I read Agony and the Ecstasy. And also, I really got into wine when I was in my early 20s. And so, I grew up in California. And I went to school in San Luis Obispo. And, like, that's, like, Edna Valley and close to Santa Barbara. And I ended up finishing school in Santa Cruz. So, Santa Cruz Mountain Wine. I mean, I was, like, literally just, like, always rolling in, like, wine tours. And so I wanted to for a while. I considered being an enologist. I had books on wine, and I specifically had books on Italian wine. And so I was just in – it was like one of these ways. Wine, like, to me from a really young age was like this idea of like having this – like, I just always – like, I am a competitor, and so I wanted to know all the things about wine, and because I also thought it gave me this advantage of, like, you know, when I was deeply uncomfortable in who I was forever, and this is why I always have been outwardly trying to succeed, because that's where my worth is wrapped up. And so this idea of dominating wine was this, like, and how – and knowing it and how to, like, order it and how to, like, talk about it was, like, part of this, like, persona that I thought was – what was important. And so there was always this fascination around wine because it felt like this way in to being somebody, right? Like part of a persona I was building, you know, of like the career trajectory. I lived in, you know, like moving in San Francisco, like having the right clothes, having the right friends, having a wine fridge, you know, or whatever. So I think like there was this like specific obsession around Italy, and then
how did that change, right? Like, anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the irony of it is that I quit drinking in my first trip to Sicily was in July 2013, and my like I finally quit drinking for good in April 2013. So not even like 3 months before I quit drinking, I finally went to the motherland and didn't have wine. And so I've never had, like, and I think, like, this is just, like.
But what is that like?
It's just like you would have, I don't know how to say it other than to say, like, I didn't even, like, that first trip was hard for sure. Like, not hard, like, hard in the way that I felt, like, I mean, this was before I learned that other people's discomfort with my not drinking was their problem and not my problem. And I think when you're the sober person and you're going on wine tours and, like, you're sitting around and you're the sober person and everyone's drinking and, like, you are, kind of a flashlight on other people's potential problematic drinking. It just is. It brings it up. Not for everybody, but if somebody has a crappy relationship with alcohol, they are not going to be super comfortable with you deciding not to drink alcohol. And so I think, like, I was still, like, new at navigating those conversations, but I just was also so, like, in love with life and, like, so in love with, like, I mean, I thought I was going to die. Like, a year before that was, like, Costa Rica and not even 9 months before that. And, like, I thought my life was done and I thought, like, it would either – like, it was so alcohol-centric. And I think this is, like, the most – like, this is the part, right? We put alcohol at the center. Like, it just is this, like – this is a construct. It's not, like – it's actually the way it is. It's a construct. And we put alcohol, we prioritize it into this thing. And we think, well, we can't, like, oh my God, like, what do you do in Italy without, well, what do you do in Italy without wine? Like, I mean, everything.
How about pasta?
Oh my God, like, yes. It is, I've eaten my way through Italy, and I, like, everything that you can imagine doing in Italy, you can do. And wine to me, just because I made a conscious decision, like, this is not important to me anymore. Like, all that, like, it can, I can live and be happy and eat really well and have, you know, great sex and have, like, great dates and have a great life and not have it, and not have wine wrapped up in the story. And when you make that decision, then the reality follows. And so for me, like, that first trip, while it was still really, like, of my, like, while I was still navigating it, the funny thing is that was where at the end of my meal, every waiter brought me a free, like, limoncello or, like, grappa, or, like, tried to, like, you know, bring me a free house wine. And, like, it just was, like, coming at me left and right because I was still, like, drunk. Like, my energy was still caught up in it. I was still trying to, like, I was nervous about that trip. But I went back and, you know, I guess, like, April, May, and June of 2014. And I quit my job and I went there for an extended period. And, like, it just didn't even come up, you know? It, like, just...
It must be sort of a relief. I wonder if you replaced all that energy and the study and the self being wrapped up in wine with being wrapped up in being an entrepreneur. Because really, that's what your energy has been invested in the last 6 years, really.
Yeah.
Is starting this amazing company and reading every single thing that you can and talking to all the people you can. And I mean, it just seems like this notion of, like, dominating a category, you moved it from, you know, intellectual side of alcohol to the company that you built.
Well, I mean, I think, like, it's fair to say, like, my whole life wasn't wrapped up in wine, like, before. Right. I, like, also was, like, really wrapped up in being successful in my career. And I think it's just, I'm an extremist. And I think that's the part of it. But, like, I jumped into this because it was so, like, it was almost like the perfect intersection of my background was in healthcare. I was, my job at the time was director of revenue cycle management, which means nothing except that I was really focused on the healthcare industry and how people got sick and how people got well and how we paid for that. And when I got sick and the healthcare industry was not something I could turn to, and the options that were outside of it that I was supposed to use, like AA, were not for me either. There was this, like, just this startling adventure through, like, being completely on the outside, like struggling with something that 3 million people a year die from, and, like, struggling from something that is, like, the fourth leading cause of preventable death in the United States, and having to, like, piece it together, you know, and, like, myself, by myself, without a support system, because I didn't go the way that, like, the one way that I was supposed to go. So I think that there was just this, like, there was a horror and an anger at that. And that it was also juxtaposed against my mom's own battle with cancer and all the support she got and the way her insurance card worked and the way we walked the Susan G. Komen and the way, like, all of the parallels between that. And there was just this, like, there was the missing of the mark. There was the fact that the work I was doing, like, should have covered addiction. Like, the company I worked at should have known how to deal with addiction and didn't. And my job should have known how to deal with addiction, and I didn't. And so I was, like, investing all my time in building something that failed me. And I was looking at how other people had experiences that were more palatable and how they were served. And then also there was just the piece of, like to me it was just so obvious. And also the other piece of this, and I think this is, like, a really important to state, the other piece of this was there was this, like, this epiphany around alcohol and how much we just assume we can't live without it, and that there's some, like, that the consequences that you can't drink. And so there was those things came together of, like, oh my God, like, to me it was like this, like, to me it was honestly like we've been duped into believing alcohol is, like, this thing that's necessary in order to have a happy life. And all of that came together, and that was, there was, like, when you stop drinking and, like, and stop using drugs and stop, you know, like when, like, all the things I did, like, that took time. And so much
you had a
time.
Lot more time. You had a lot more time on
your
hands.
More time on my hands, right. Yeah. And also there was just, like, this perfect place for my passion to go. And
And that's, yeah, that's it. Like, yes, like I'm an extremist, all these things kind of like boiled together. And I'm extremely passionate about, like, I don't want anybody that, like, I don't want, like, when I see people suffering and dying from addiction, and when I read the news stories and I see the way we still think about it and look at it largely. And I mean, my biggest, like, my, I wrote a piece when Philip Seymour Hoffman died. I hadn't decided, I had quit my job, but I hadn't decided I was going to start this company. And I, when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, and I started seeing the sensationalism of it, and also this just like this discussion around, well, it's just his demons that got him, and this like this same old trope and the same old idea, and also that like potentially he didn't, like he was, like his only choice was AA, and that may not have been for him. And this, and the way that we all like just look over there and we think something's wrong with that guy, instead of what's wrong with our society, instead of what's wrong with the way we couldn't have supported him. And why was he the, like, why was he sick? Why did he need to use drugs? Why, what, like, and how is this unfolding in our lives in these other ways? And how is this unfolding around us? I think there was just this, like, there was this, like, just anger at the way that we, that people that struggle with addiction are treated and written off and talked about, and the way it's just, like, a their problem and it's not an us thing.
And so let's just – I'm curious because you took all that anger, mm-hmm. and you focused it on building something. What is it for listeners, I'm always so curious, like, what is your takeaway about the things that you needed to have in line to build your company? Like, what were, aside from the passion, which is clear, the anger, which is very motivating,
yeah,
the time, because you got a lot of it back,
yeah.
But what else was it, you know, for all those entrepreneurs out there, like, what else did you feel like you needed that you got together?
The ingredient. Well, I think it was finally believing that I could do it. You know, I'd always like been in relationships with really powerful men, and I'd like it. Like, I always perceived that that I could never stand in front of a room and lead it. That I could never stand in front of a cause, and I just had. I was always a behind the scenes kind of person, you know, that wanted to lead so badly, and that like it was, you know, like the work of. It's not numbing your way through life is the work of like confronting all of the things within you, all the limitations that you thought you had. If you can quit drinking, like if I could do what I did, I could do anything. And that was a huge part of this. And I think like so many of us, like we just don't, we like live in the safe little bubble of our comfort zone. I thought I can't leave my job. I can't leave the security of this paycheck. I can't ask people for money. I can't, you know, like I can't figure out a business plan. I can't get people to believe in this. I can't, you know, like it was just like all these like limitations we stack on ourselves without even trying. And it was just like, oh my, like life is so short and this world is our playground. And like we can jump and we can fall and we can get back up again. And like there was just this refusal to be limited by like everything I had placed on myself, and this refusal to like take no for an answer, and like, and this refusal to like really give a care if people like if people didn't believe in it. I believed in it, and that was enough. And so I think like there was just this like, you know, there's this quote, and it's a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, and it was it's God doesn't make his work manifest by cowards. I think I just slaughtered it a little bit. But like the idea is like if you like God does not give his work to cowards means like if you have it in you, it's not a mistake, right? And like it's given to you in order to bring it through you. And it's not about you usually. Like the work that I do is not like some like it's a balance, and I believe me, there is a lot of still trying to make my worth equal to what I do. But like at the end of the day, the thing that keeps me going is like believing that something is being channeled, that the experiences I had were not an accident. They were for a reason. They were given divinely to me. The combination of everything I'd experienced and also the desire to want to lead a company and also in the addiction space and use my life as the like base of it and like have to like talk to investors about like, you know, my, it's just like, it's like, there's just like the chaos and the way it all came together and formed into this like beautiful vision that made sense to me was like, I mean, there was just this, like, this is my duty to do this. And I say that, like, out of like this knowing that all of us like have this like this kind of duty that we're given. We're all given these like really different things that we're supposed to do, and it doesn't have to make sense to anybody else. And so I think it's like it's the combination of realizing this is a responsibility when you're given a creative vision, or when you're given like a desire or a passion, and it's weird, or like it's especially if it's weird, like that's a duty to bring forth. Like you're a vessel, you're a channel, you're the faucet, not the water. And so that's part of it. And then also just realizing like, what do I really have to lose, right? Like, what is it that I, at the end of the day, what do I have to lose by going for this?
So let's talk about one of your most important phrases, and that's how we'll end along with paying it forward. But love is the most important thing to you.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Did you see what I wrote on Instagram?
I did.
Okay. So I think it's important context to say that you asked me, why do I sign everything with love? And I thought about it, like, I think my immediate response was, because I do. But to me, I think, like, I had to think about it. And I was like, it's just, like, first of all, it's just this, I think one of the most important pieces of it is the population that I work with. And alcohol addiction, or all addictions, they're so, like, strongly tied into morality, like this idea that we make these decisions like against our better, like that we're moral degenerates if we're, you know, like somebody that you see on the street that keeps shooting up and is like doing God knows what in order to pay for drugs, or someone that like under the influence drives their car and kills a family and they're alive to deal with it. I mean, this is a thing that happens. I work with people that have done potentially terrible and horrible things. And I have done terrible and horrible things. And I, like, to myself, and like if, like, while I was in it, this, if I was going to work and saying, oh, yeah, well, last night I slept in my bed with no sheets and I puked and I, you know what I mean? Like, I, like, it's revived, like, it's just, like, the, like, humans are disgusting. And, like, addiction is especially this thing that can be, like, super disgusting. Like, if we're just talking about it, like, and so I think that there is this sense of, like, the love comes from this, like, there is, it's like the Christ love or the Martin Luther King love or, like, the Gandhi love of just the love no matter what, right? It's the love that you have that, like, it's your duty to have for people because, like, what else is there? And I think, like, one of my teachers, Stephanie Snyder, like we at the end when I had a podcast, we asked her what does she think her job is, and her job is to remember to see God in everybody, and what she meant by that was just remembering to see the divinity in every single person, and that we all like kind of share this. And I think that's what my job is too, in doing the work that I do. At the end of the day, it's about like seeing the basic goodness that we all share and reminding people that they have it, because the problem with people is not that they're so like full of themselves and like full of their love. The problem is that they have forgotten that they have that. They forget that they're already redeemed. They forget that worth isn't earned. They forget that they're just inherently worthy, and especially the population I work with. And so I think it's like that, but it's just, it's also something that I think is, no, I mean, I'll just like leave it there. It's just, it's important because it's the only ingredient that matters. And
we'll stop there.
Yeah.
and then the last, pay it forward. So I always ask my guests to highlight someone who they admire, who they think other people should know about. It could be an author. It could be a chef. It could be someone who's inspired you, but not your mother.
Yeah, I think it's who I just mentioned, Stephanie Snyder. She has a wonderful TED Talk. She's a yoga teacher out of San Francisco, and I found her in my darkest hours. I found her TED Talk, and then I took classes from her on Yoga Glow, and then I went to her real life classes and learned and took yoga teacher training from her. But I think she's sober, and she has an incredible story. She's married to the lead singer of Rancid. Is it Rancid? Oh my God, Lars. Anyway, but it's just she's this beautiful human in every possible way. And she, to me, is she's the real deal. She lives it. She lives what she teaches. And so I would say Stephanie Snyder, find her, follow her, go to her classes.
That's great. And where can people find you?
So our company is now rebranded to Tempest, and so you can go to jointempest.com, and we also have a media site called The Temper, so just thetemper.com, and that's media dedicated to focusing on, you know, and focusing on dismantling the idea that, you know, alcohol is the only thing worth doing in society, and so, then also on, I'm active on Instagram, so at Holly on Instagram.
Just at Holly?
Yeah, just at Holly.
It's amazing that you could... get just at Holly.
Friends.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was lucky.
That's impressive. sorry, pause there. You guys know where to find me at FW Scout on Instagram and Twitter and at Speaking Broadly on Instagram. As always, welcome your comments and thoughts, suggestions for people who you'd love to hear more from about how they've navigated their way through life to get to a happy place. And... that's it. Have a great week and see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.